Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Local 82 against Crowley. We'll just wait till the courtroom clears, counsel. I don't know if our ushers make these people sit down if they're going to stay.
Chief Justice, and many police court. Today we ask the court to determine whether union elections of officers are to be run under the supervision of the federal judiciary or the Secretary of Labor. The key question is whether a court can order a union to conduct a new election of officers under Title I of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act in response to a suit filed by someone other than the Secretary of Labor. It is our position that Congress vested the Secretary, and only the Secretary, with authority to bring suit to rerun an election of union officers. Congress repeatedly rejected other enforcement schemes, including suit by individual union members, both before and after the addition of Title I to the legislation. And all of the bills considered over the course of two sessions of Congress relied upon the Secretary of Labor as the agent of government to supervise the rerun of union election of officers. Thus, we seek reversal of the lower courts and reaffirmation of this court's prior decisions that Title IV, not Title I, is to be utilized to resolve challenges to elections of union officers. We ask that the ballots cast by the members of Local 82 in the 1980 election be returned to the union for tabulation. I would like to highlight several of the facts set forth more fully in our brief. First, suit here was filed based upon alleged violations of Titles 1 and 4 of the Act, which occurred at the union's nomination meeting. The suit was not filed until after the union had mailed the mail balloting packets to its members for voting in the election. A temporary restraining order was subsequently issued without an evidentiary hearing, some 17 hours before the ballots were to be picked up and tabulated. For the stated purpose of preserving the court's jurisdiction, and in order to prevent the plaintiffs, the respondents in this case, from having to go through the electoral processes of challenging an election under Title IV. As a result, the union was unable to elect officers for an additional year after the temporary restraining order was issued. In the interim, the union was run by officers who had been elected 4 years previously. The new election ordered by the court was conducted under its rules and under its court-appointed arbitrators. And presently pending before the district court, lo these many years later, is the application for attorney's fees on behalf of respondents, is a request for permanent relief, is the union's expected expense for reimbursement for the costs of the election that were conducted under the court's order, and for petitioner Harris's claims for wages if it should be found that he was the successful candidate in the 1980 election.
Who ends up paying for these arbitrator or the whoever it is the court appoints?
The union paid for the entire cost of the election, including the arbitrator, with the understanding, which was discussed at the time, that the union could seek reimbursement from the plaintiffs if the district court's injunction was ultimately overturned.
Would there have been that sort of expense to either part if the secretary had brought the injunctive action?
Certainly some of the expenses of conducting an election would have been incurred, but the major expense, that of in excess of $7,000 to pay the arbitrator's expenses, would not have been incurred because the Secretary of Labor does not charge the union for its expenses and personnel in conducting the election. That is the greatest bulk of the expense.
Mr. Woodland.
Procedures for the election under the court order, like the procedures that the secretary would follow under four.
There were major discrepancies between what the secretary would do and what the union would do and what the court ordered.
Can you say briefly what the difference would be?
Primarily, the arbitrators that were appointed did not have the expertise of the secretary to make evaluations as to the application of the secretary's own administrative regulations or the union's constitutional regulations and requirements.
The question I wanted to ask you, if I might, is the violations here concern the nomination meeting, as I remember it.
That's correct.
Would you make basically the same argument that you make today if the action had been brought promptly after the nomination meeting and after the alleged violations occurred?
We would not be making the same argument if the suit was brought prior to the time the ballots were mailed out.
But wouldn't some of your policy arguments be equally strong about having the wrong people running the election and so forth?
If we were to address that question prior to Calhoun and ignoring the prior cases of this court, we would say that the public policy issues and the legislative history arguments clearly discern a congressional intent that there'd be no pre-election Title I relief. The arguments that we made were in recognition of the language in Calhoun and in Bukowski that seems to recognize some appropriate role for a court under Title I. And therefore, the line we're asking is a line that we would be happy to see the court extend, i.e., to say there is no Title I relief. But we think that the line can be drawn in our favor in this case without going that far.
But the whole question really is, at what point in time has the election been conducted then?
No, it's not the whole point, because that
in itself. So this is a little different theory than Judge Campbell had, as I understand it. Then.
It's only marginally different from Judge Campbell. Our basic theory is that once you get to the point where the only remedy in order to grant the relief requested is to conduct a new election, the court does not have Title I jurisdiction.
Well, that could have happened if they brought the suit right after the nomination meeting, that the only effective remedy might be a court-supervised election.
No, I think that at that point, the court could have merely nullified the nomination meeting, gone back to the union and said, do it again. There had been no ballots printed or distributed at that time. I agree, however, that the logic of the public policy arguments and the logic of the legislative history that's set forth in our brief is that even at that point, the court should not have had Title I jurisdiction to challenge even the nomination meeting, considering the nomination meeting to be part of the election.
The ballots have been cast. Do you think the election has, in effect, been had?
Certainly, which is the case in this case.
Well, there wasn't any legislative history about Title I except on the floor.
That's correct.
It didn't go through a committee?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
And no hearings on that aspect of it?
No, there is no discussion in the legislative history.
It was written on the floor?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You say had quarrel with some language in Calhoun, or what was the other one?
Bukowski.
Oh, yeah.
The legislative history that we've been referring to, I believe, makes at least three things clear about what the intent of Congress was in passing the statute. First is that Title IV was intended to be the specific vehicle for resolving disputes concerning the conduct of union election of officers. And that procedure, in the Section 402 procedures, were intended to provide the exclusive means of obtaining an order, setting aside an election, and providing for a rerun. And finally, that the statutory goals of democratic elections could not be ensured by any agent of the government other than the Secretary of Labor. And it bears repeating that all of the bills considered in the House and the Senate provided that rerun elections were to be conducted by the Secretary of Labor, regardless of how you happen to get to the point of having an order to rerun the election. I submit that this case provides a textbook example of how the safeguards and objectives carefully established in Title IV will inevitably be nullified when a court, acting under Title I, is permitted to substitute its judgment as to how an election should be conducted for that of the Secretary, the Congress, or the union involved. For example, the statute specifies that elections are to be conducted no less frequently than once every 3 years, and that the winners are to be installed regardless of whether there is a challenge to the outcome of that election. Well, here, we did not have an election for 4 years, and in the interim, we had lame duck officers responsible for running the union.
Was an election conducted this January?
There was an election conducted in December of 1983, Your Honor.
December.
Yes.
And so why is it not moot?
There are a number of arguments made on behalf of why it is not moot. First is that in order to resolve the matters presently pending before the district court, we must have the determination from this court as to whether the district court had jurisdiction to issue the type of relief it ordered. Second, the court itself has held in glass bottle blowers the happenstance occurrence of an intervening election does not deprive either the secretary or the courts of the authority to go back to investigate the prior election in order to determine whether any of the alleged violations which occurred in that election could have tainted the second election. And we think that's certainly a case here. One of the issues that was never resolved by the district court in this case was the legality of the continuous good standing requirement as a condition of eligibility to run for office. That is a question that has not been resolved. And finally, we believe that this case would fall within the court's general parameters of a case capable of repetition yet evading review because of the short time limitation and the time it takes to get a case up to this court. Another statutory goal that cannot be accomplished under Title I is that of specifying that the statute only specifies minimal government intervention in union affairs and leaves it to the unions to establish rules in its bylaws as to how the election be conducted. And the union has been found to be free to conduct its elections in accordance with its own procedures so long as the procedures comply with the statute. Here, in contrast, the district court issued an injunction which provided for detailed rules, took the entire administration of the election procedures out of the hands of the union, and placed them into the hands of arbitrators that it happened to find willing to conduct this type of election. Most importantly, the congressional history indicates an intent to reserve challenges to the conduct of the election until after the election has been completed, and to prevent any faction in the union from delaying the election. And even once that election was completed, if a member sought to challenge its outcome, court intervention was to be delayed until after the union was given an opportunity to review the problem and attempt to redress the grievance. And then, if a member was dissatisfied with the union's action, until the Secretary of Labor, the agent of government most familiar with the union's affairs, conducted an investigation and made it determine not only that there was a violation, but the violation affected the outcome of the election. Elections were not to be set aside merely for technical violations, and they were only to be set aside after hearing on the merits of the case. Here, the relief that was granted was granted after a hearing on a preliminary injunction. There never was a hearing on the merits. The respondents were not required to exhaust the internal union procedures, and the union was not given full advantage of those procedures to remedy this matter itself. There was no compliance with the time limitations, which severely restrict the amount of time that the Secretary of Labor has to investigate a complaint and file a suit. And most importantly, the procedures entirely ignored the Secretary of Labor, precluding him from investigating the complaint, precluding him from being able to attempt to settle a complaint before it was actually filed in court, precluding him from serving as a screening agent to prevent the court from spending time on frivolous issues, and preventing him from consolidating all of the potential litigation concerning the outcome of the election in one proceeding before one court. In fact, by deciding some of the issues here under Title I, but deferring other issues for a Title IV proceeding, the district court, in essence, ensured that there will be two elections, two suits, to challenge the outcome of this election. And indeed, by not resolving the 24th consecutive month continuous good standing eligibility requirement, the court did not even guarantee that his own election was to be protected from a challenge after that election had been challenged. Thus, we do not believe that the statutory goals can be accomplished in a proceeding under Title I. And for that reason, we do not believe that it can ever be appropriate within the meaning of Section 102 for a court acting under Title I to grant the relief of ordering a union to conduct a new election of officers.
Enjoin one? I suppose it can, in a sense, if you can set aside nominations.
It would depend at what...
I thought you agreed they could set aside nominations under Title I.
It would depend at what point the election was sought to be enjoined and what relief was being requested.
Well, the only request is to hold a new nominating meeting.
And that the election be enjoined until such time as that could take place.
Well, there can't be an election without some nominations.
Yes. If that type of suit was brought prior to the mechanics of the balloting taking place, and it relied upon a legitimate Title I basis for its complaint, then we think that the prior decisions of this court suggest that the district court does have jurisdiction to entertain such a suit.
And so appropriate injunctive relief is...
It might be appropriate under the correct circumstances, yes.
Now, if you go that far, supposing they do decide, well, we'll have to have the election 2 weeks late because of the nomination, and we've enjoined the old elections that have a new nomination meeting, and I will order that there'll be some impartial observer at the election. Just one, would that be a, he'd have no power to enter that kind of an order?
No, I don't believe that he does, Your Honor.
Any relief that pertains to the conduct of the election itself is statutory, beyond his statutory power.
Anything which inserts the court in the actual conduct of the election, we believe, is beyond the statutory power.
But you wouldn't go so far as to say he couldn't delay the election for 2 weeks and then say, go ahead and conduct it pursuant to your normal rules?
Not in the appropriate circumstances. And that is when the suit is, in fact, based upon a legitimate Title I issue and when it has been brought at a time before the balloting has taken place.
He could change the date of the election, but could otherwise exercise no supervision whatsoever over it. That's your position.
That's correct.
Under Title IV, subject to review?
Certainly. Under this court's decision in Bukowski, a member who has been denied a new election from the secretary can seek review of the secretary's decision.
And So it's merely a question of exhaustion rather than judicial power.
Certainly. We are not saying that the courts have no role to conduct in the conduct of elections, but merely that that role was deliberately, intentionally, and repeatedly delayed until after these other procedures had been exhausted, the union's exhaustion and the Secretary of Labor's exhaustion.
Mr. Whitman, who would invoke the Secretary's authority?
Any complaining member has a right to go to...
Well, take your situation. Suppose there had been an injunction setting aside the initial nominating meeting and calling for another one.
Yes.
And at that point, they have one, and nominees now. How do you get the secretary in?
Any of the respondents could have filed a complaint with the union,
really?
And 30 days thereafter, gone to the Secretary of Labor.
But there has to be that waiting period of 30 days, doesn't it?
There has to be a time for the union's procedures to work, and then either 30 days after not getting a decision from the union or 30 days after the union decision, then they go to the secretary.
Well, you have a nomination meeting and the election is 2 weeks later, now, can you? Under Title I, you can go right into court, I gather. You don't have to wait 30 days?
That is correct. There is no exhaustion, I should say there is an exhaustion requirement, but it is more easily waivable by the district court than the statutory requirement under Title IV. Mm-hmm. I'd like to reserve the remaining time, Bill.
Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Let me begin by saying a word about a question that Justice Brennan asked, how, if the Secretary had conducted this election, might it have been run differently? Let me give a few general examples and then a few specific examples. Section 402 of Title IV says that when elections are to be rerun, they are to be rerun in accordance with regulations that the Secretary is to promulgate. Those regulations appear in Part 452 of 29 CFR. And I think it goes without saying that in running the election, the Secretary would be more familiar with the operation of those regulations than would a court. Second difference is that this is the first time that the district judge had rerun a Teamster election, and he was no doubt not as familiar with the Teamsters' constitution and bylaws as the Secretary would be, because this would not be the first time the Secretary had rerun a Teamsters election. Some more particular examples might be one of the things that we don't find in the district court's injunction that the Secretary does do in the course of elections is to read all of the publications that are sent out in the course of the election, not just campaign materials, but the Secretary rereads the proofs of the newspaper that the union circulates, for example, to make sure that it doesn't support one side rather than the other. We don't see any provision for that. So in that sense, the Secretary would often do more than the district court did. In some cases, the Secretary would do less than the district court did. For example, the injunction here provides that the arbitrators were actually to run the nominations meeting so that somebody would be up at the podium running the meeting. When the Secretary has a nominations meeting rerun, they have a pre-election conference at which the rules for conducting the meeting will be set out, and there will be an observer there taking notes to make sure that things go all right, but it won't actually be run by the Secretary. So sometimes they do more, sometimes they do less, sometimes they simply do things differently. For example, in the joint appendix, I noticed that in the district court's docket that one of the issues that arose in the course of this election was a question about whether James Miller was eligible. And under the district court's injunction, those questions about eligibility were to be determined in the first instance by the arbitrators and then taken to court. If the Secretary had been running elections, had been rerunning the election, and there were nothing faulty about the union's own procedures for determining eligibility requirements, the appeals on eligibility questions would have followed those normal procedures to the union's general president and then the general executive board and then to the Secretary if there was some problem with that.
Was there objection to the order before it was entered by counsel to the district
by the court? Secretary or by the parties?
By anybody.
There was considerable negotiation in the district court once it had been decided that the court was going to enjoin the election.
Well, was it ever pointed out to the court that it would be improper for the court to run the election?
Yes, indeed. I believe that was the basis for the union's objection.
And this was before the court entered the judgment or afterwards?
Yes. No, that was before the district court entered the injunction. The Secretary did not intervene in this action until the Court of Appeals.
Yeah.
Mr. Garvey, I assume you have no trouble with mootness either.
No, we do not, Your Honor, both for the reasons mentioned by the petitioners and because we believe that the district court, by grabbing the ballots in this case, has prevented the Secretary from performing his role in the Title IV statutory scheme up until today and until those ballots are released.
You don't complain about this last election. you don't find any fault with this last election.
There have not been any complaints. The secretary isn't entitled to act on his own until he receives a complaint, and to date there have been none.
Where does the secretary draw the line between Title I or
That's the other thing
Title
I wanted
IV,
to address in the time I had remaining. Let me first say a word about where we get the line.
Unless he gives Title I no room at all.
No, that's not so. The secretary does give play for Title I. The line that we would draw is that, let me back up just one step and tell you where we get it. In the statute, we think Congress could have been a little bit more explicit than it was about how Titles I and IV ought to fit together, but we think it gave at least three signals. The first of those is that Section 402 sets out a very detailed system, which Mr. Whitlin outlined, for rerunning elections. Second signal is that Section 102, as you suggested, cautions the district courts in Title I cases that they are to provide only such relief as is appropriate. The third signal that Congress gave is in Section 403, which says that the Title IV procedure for challenging an election which has been already conducted shall be exclusive. Now, that language doesn't solve this case completely, or we wouldn't be here, but its purpose, I think, provides considerable assistance, because the reason Congress put it in the statute was that Congress didn't want courts rerunning elections. In line with all of that, the line that we would propose for accommodating these is that Title IV relief, Title I relief, should never be considered appropriate under Section 102 if Title IV relief is adequate to resolve the election violations that are being complained of. Now, let me give an example or two about what kinds of Title I relief would be appropriate in the context of union officer elections. One is the Finnegan case that this court decided 2 years ago. That involved complaints about equal rights and free speech in the context of a union officer election. You may recall that their union's business representative had been discharged after supporting the incumbents who lost the election. In that sort of case, there isn't relief available under Title IV because what he wanted was reinstatement, and running a new election wouldn't give him that necessarily. Let me give another example. In the Sadlowski case, decided the same term as Finnegan, there was again a complaint about free speech rights in connection with a union officer election. There, the complaint was that the union had improperly amended its constitution to forbid non-member campaign contributions. In that case, Title IV relief wouldn't be adequate because there wasn't an election even on the horizon.
What about this case? Was Title IV the exclusive remedy for anything that happened at that nominating meeting? That's really.
I don't know that Title IV is the exclusive remedy for anything that happened.
No, in this case.
But the election could only be rerun under Title IV.
I understand that, but isn't my question. What under Title I could these complainants have done?
They might have sought damages.
After the election, that's all.
Or
sought damages,
or
what else?
They might have sought damages. They.
Do you agree that they might have run into court and got an injunction setting aside the nomination meeting? As your colleague here?
No. We would draw the line short of that point. And the
so the secretary says that that kind of injunctive relief would be barred.
That's right.
But union does not agree with you.
Mr. Whitlin represented that they weren't going to be that strict about it. But we would draw the line short of rerunning the nominations meeting because that kind of relief, let me give you another example in the course of this election about what might have been done. Suppose that these respondents were complaining that they hadn't been given ballots. I think that injunctive relief under Title I might be appropriate to direct that they be given ballots. Now, that sort of relief, unlike rerunning the nominations meeting, unlike what happened here, in that sort of situation, there isn't the delay of the election which was involved.
Could the court order that they be considered nominated and be put on the ballot?
I am reluctant to say no because Professor Cox suggested in the course of the Senate hearings on this that might be an appropriate remedy to order in this case that Mr. Lynch's name be put on the ballot for Secretary Treasurer. But again, that, unlike rerunning the nominations meeting, doesn't involve any delay, doesn't get the court involved in the details of how the meeting shall be run.
Most courts don't get these things heard in 2 or 3 days, and that might take 2 or 3 weeks to even get before the judge for a decent hearing. Can he enter a restraining order meanwhile?
That gives me trouble. And even if the district court
did... Well, if you say no, you're in effect saying there is no Title I relief for anything in this case.
I'm perfectly willing to say that there is no equitable Title I relief for the problem in this case, because the Title IV relief is perfectly adequate to resolve this problem. As we point out in our reply brief, the kinds of violations that the district court suggested might be meritorious, the exclusion of Lynch from the ballot, the exclusion of Crowley and others from the nominations meeting, would have proven to be Title IV violations that would justify rerunning the nominations meeting and rerunning the election, precisely the relief that the district court afforded in this case. On the other hand, neither the Court of Appeals nor the respondents has advanced any advantage that Title I actually holds over Title IV procedures in the context of this very case. One of the suggestions that's made is that somehow, I see my time is expiring.
Now, Mr. Question. On this mootness point, you ask us to order that the ballots be returned to the petitioner. What good does that do?
It's only after the ballots have been counted that a claimant is entitled to come to the secretary with a complaint. Yes.
This stage.
That's right.
So we just ignore the new election?
No, not necessarily. What would happen is
Do we do with the new election?
Perhaps nothing, but that's the decision that has to be made by the secretary. If the ballots are counted,
can we have something to do with deciding that? Or do we have to just
perhaps eventually, after the secretary brings the suit.
I mean, you didn't bring this case to the secretary, you brought it to us.
We did indeed, to complain that the district court had prevented the secretary from acting. But if I may just answer your question about what you should do. If the ballots are returned to the petitioners, they will then be counted. And members are at that point entitled to complain to the secretary about the violations which the district court unsuccessfully, we suggest, attempted to remedy. At that point, under 402B, the secretary is to determine if there are violations which have occurred and not been corrected. Now, it is possible that the secretary will conclude that as a result of the district court's rerun and the subsequent supervening 1983 election, that it may not be necessary to ignore the 1983 election and do it all over again. On the other hand, it may be so, and that's a decision which can't be made until the case is brought before the secretary.
Mr. Stern.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The issues raised on this appeal are less numerous and of less general application than the government and the union have suggested. The mootness issue here is primarily one of whether a party may seek to disturb on appeal portions of a district court order to which it stipulated, namely, the running of a new election. That was
to the fact that there should be a new election.
Yes, they did, Your Honor. They did not stipulate to its being court supervised. They specifically stipulated to a new election in an attempt to deprive the court of jurisdiction. And I mention only after, Your Honor, that they heard the evidence in the preliminary injunction hearings did they make that offer. It was not because of the temporary restraining order, Justice White, but after they heard the evidence that they made that offer, when they realized this was going to be rerun at one point or another, and it would be less disruptive and less unsettling to the union to rerun it sooner rather than later.
They never agreed that a court should run it. They never stipulated that. I don't suppose they'd even be here if they thought it was all right for the court to run the election.
They did not feel it was all right for the court to run the election. And in fact, that is why the factors mentioned by the government existed. The union refused to run the election. The union refused to run the election meeting. The union refused to name arbitrators. The union, in fact, blocked the AAA from being the arbitrators rather than the Honest Ballot Association by calling them up and telling them they didn't approve of that. And the union did not have any publications to be sent out, didn't have any publications that were sent out. So it wasn't because the secretary didn't run this election that the union wasn't involved in the meeting or in determining who was going to run that meeting. It was because the union refused to, and strictly because the union refused to. Now, second issue in this litigation is, as was mentioned by Justice O'Connor, whether the election, and Justice Marshall, whether the election has become moot as a result of the December 1983 election. And I suggest you have to really stretch the imagination, as the Secretary of Labor did, to come up with a reason why this case isn't moot on that account. And lastly, the one question on the merits that is before the court is whether a district court is so restricted in its remedial powers under Title I of the Landrum-Giffen Act that it cannot order minimal supervision and the few terms it actually imposed on the union to remedy the flagrant violations of Title I that occurred in this case. Now, I ask you, the court, to consider the fact that when a Title IV election is rerun, it is the court, not the Secretary of Labor, that sets the terms for rerunning that election. It is the Secretary of Labor who investigates the complaint and who goes and observes the election. But it is the court that sets the terms. It is not an issue.
How often do district courts get into that posture?
Every time there's a recalcitrant union that doesn't settle the matter in conciliation proceedings, the court must get into that posture. The secretary has no power to order a new election. A court must order it.
Once ordered, why can't the district judge let the secretary take over?
He can, but I believe the practice is that the secretary submits a proposed order to the court, and the court acts on the proposed order, and therefore it is the court's order that is, in fact, what determines the terms. Now, what opposing parties argue here is that a court is not that the court lacked jurisdiction, because the secretary concedes that, as do the union and the government and the AFL-CIO. What they do argue in essence is that the only power a court has is to grant damages in a situation such as this. And I point out to your honors that this election suit was filed 3 weeks after the nomination meeting, just 1 week later than the union says would have been proper and all right. And there's nothing in the record to indicate when the ballots went out, but I suggest that if they had gone out by the 3 week time, they probably had gone out by the 2 week time. In fact, to rule that when the ballots go out is the determining factor gives every union a way out of getting any relief under Title I. As soon as nominations are made, you walk over to the printer, you Xerox your ballots, and you mail them out. It takes a day. Nobody can get into court with that speed and get relief. Now, an award of damages cannot correct a violation of in a nomination meeting. It cannot correct a violation that takes place during an electoral process but before the conclusion of it. All it can do is attach a stigma to the person who complains about the violation of having gotten damages against the union, taken money out of the treasury of the union for him or herself, a stigma that they cannot get rid of. Now, that if they had accomplished something else, gotten a new election run, in the process, that stigma would not be serious. But having no other...
Well, the Secretary of Labor could order that on their theory.
Yes, but if you have a recalcitrant union, the Secretary of Labor in practice cannot order that until the term has virtually run out for the people elected unlawfully. It takes an average of 2.5 years for cases litigated. The maximum term under the Act is 3 years. That is more than 75% of the term having been sat and run, the union run, by the people unlawfully elected. And anyone unlawfully elected can take the 90 days, not 30 days, under the Act for that they must give the union to consider the matter internally, take the 60 days of the secretary, and delay on top of that another 2 years in the courts before an order is issued. It doesn't take much, if any, skill to do that.
Why can't the secretary act without the court action?
Only if the union agrees. And if you have a person who has engaged in flagrant violations of Title I, Justice O'Connor, I suggest that is not the person who will agree, who will make the conciliation or correct it internally. That is the determination of fact that Judge Keaton made in this case. Now, the proposition that damages are the only relief that can be effectively granted in an electoral process under Title I flies in the face of the legislative history, the language, and this Court's interpretation of the Act, and it's incompatible with the primary purpose of the Act. In Hall v. Cole, this Court determined that district courts have great flexibility and discretion in fashioning appropriate remedies for violations of Title I. In the Steelworkers decision, this Court determined that in the electoral process, Title I rights are particularly critical and deserve vigorous protection. To separate those two propositions from each other, to accept the one from the other and vice versa, largely nullifies Title I in what this Court has determined to be the most important area for its functioning. And I would also suggest virtually the only area in which members of unions interested in promoting democracy in their union, in fact, do come forward and act. The Title I confers on union members comparable rights to those we possess as citizens of the United States. It is the foundation of the Landrum-Griffin Act, the rights of free speech, assembly, equal treatment under the law, due process. Title IV governs the particulars of an election process. As a remedial statute, the Landrum-Griffin Act is to be broadly construed to express its goals. To adopt the position urged by the government and the union in this case will largely nullify Title I in the area that has been determined by this Court to be its most important area to function and frustrate the congressional goals expressed in the preamble to the Act. Adoption of our position in...
Do I understand you to say that the Secretary's procedures, including judicial review, mean that there's a two-year delay in conducting...
An average of 2.5 years, Justice Brennan, which is more than 75% of the term. I believe it would be 5/6 of the term.
Are there any statistics to support that?
Yes, they were cited in the in our brief and referred to the law review articles that have compiled those statistics. That's not the average for every case complaint brought to the Secretary. It's the average cases that go to litigation. But you have to assume that an officer willing to violate Title I in the flagrant fashion that these officers did is going to use every opportunity for delay under the Act and will fall into the 2.5-year average. Now, as I indicated before, damages is a liability, not a remedy, under Title I, and the granting of damages will chill, not foster, the further exercise of democratic rights by union members. There is no indication in the history of this Act that recalcitrant union leaders who unlawfully influenced an election's results are not to be removed in an expeditious and democratic fashion. In fact, the history of the Act indicates that they should be removed once it has been determined that they are unlawfully elected. And this Court, the District Court in this case, issued its orders after factual hearings held within the first month that this complaint was brought and determined that the officers were unlawfully elected. And in fact, the union concurred in that by coming forward as soon as it heard the evidence and saying a new election should be run. The union alone in this case suggests that the language already conducted in the statute should be interpreted to mean commenced, as soon as the matters are commenced. The Secretary of Labor backed off that position in its brief and reply brief. In fact, it says at the present time that this election still isn't completed and that it it's not proper for members to raise Title IV complaints about this until the ballots are taken out and counted. On the other hand, it says, seems to be saying that no injunctive relief can be granted right after the nominations meeting.
The ballots taken out and counted, then would there be a Title I remedy to, based on the allegedly illegal nominations?
No, we think the point in time of counting the ballots, once you've and letting the people know where they came out, is in fact the time that Title IV talks about as removing any matter into the area of the exclusive jurisdiction of the Secretary. To make it any
elections actually conducted.
That would be the conducting of an election.
The ballots cast and counted, is that it?
Other than injunctive relief, once injunctive relief would be barred.
No, but triggering the Secretary's authority is the conduct of the election and the counting of the ballots?
The conduct of the election would be conducted at the point that the ballots are counted. Any point earlier could make it possible for a union to accomplish that act the day after the election, after the nomination.
Suppose you decided that courts are just too slow. Before the election, could you go to the Secretary?
No, there's no way you can go to the Secretary before the election. He has no jurisdiction. The Secretary only has one remedy, a hydrogen bomb. Wipe out the old election and start fresh anew. The Secretary has no flexibility to remedy a minor violation and let the election proceed.
So you don't think the Secretary would have any jurisdiction or authority whatsoever if somebody complained to go into court to enjoin the election that hasn't been held yet?
He doesn't.
Do you have a lot of that effect?
The Kukchu Amendment took that power away from the Secretary and gave it to members. That is what the Kukchu Amendment was.
I know it gave it to members, but did it also take it away from the Secretary completely?
Yes, the Secretary says in his own regulations that he has no power to remedy Title I violations, that they are to be remedied by a different means by a member in court. That's stated in his regulations.
After the election, let's assume before the election the only complaint is the nominations, the very nominations here. And you say that you can go right into court before the election to remedy that. After the election, you have to complain to the Secretary about the very same Title I violation.
Yes. And if it was intentionally done, you can expect that it will be 2.5 years later that it is remedied, if you wait till after. Now, I'd like to address a few points made by opposing counsel in response to questions presented by the court. First, the 24-hour rule, the court below did not determine that there would have to be two court cases, because the 24-hour rule was enforced in the election that took place in 1981, and no objection was made to its going there, so there would not be a second case about it. Secondly, the union in this case could have suggested a third party with the expertise satisfactory to it. Instead, it chose to frustrate the selection of a third party and agreed to accept the third party that was nominated without agreeing to the supervision of the court in general.
Mr. Stern, don't all these arguments go to whether this particular judge handled this particular matter in a proper way rather than the power of the court to handle it at all?
I don't think there's any question that the court has the power to handle Title I violations, and I don't think there's any question in this case.
Well, as I understand your opponents, even though they may not phrase it in terms of power, they say there's virtually no power in a district court until after the election, after the election has been conducted, and we're just trying to figure out when the election has been conducted.
Yes.
There's an awful lot of argument between the parties about whether the judge did everything right or whether he's too slow or the union was recalcitrant in this case. It seems to me that's all entirely immaterial in this case. We're dealing with a rather narrow question of law.
Yes, I believe the union's recalcitrance is germane to the court's consideration on one point, and that is what the alternative remedy to these members would be when you have a person who is recalcitrant and willing to the way the processes that exist under Title IV, and only relevant to that point.
Mr. Stern, may we come back a minute to the discussion you've had previously? In this case, the district court enjoined, the district court entered the picture one day before the ballots would be counted, didn't he?
No, it entered the picture before that. That's
but he entered the injunction.
It entered
that the ballots not be counted the day before they were to be counted.
A temporary restraining order, yes,
right.
Your Honor.
If that procedure is appropriate, the Secretary's authority always could be usurped by a federal court, couldn't it?
Your Honor, I think the number of cases that this could occur in are minimal, and that is why...
Why is that? That's what I don't understand.
Because it could only occur in an overlap case in the first place, where there's a clear violation of Title I. This court determined that a court cannot do that where there are violations of Title IV and only violations.
I do understand that, but if a violation of Title I is claimed, couldn't the court always enjoin the counting of the ballots?
Yes, it could if it deemed it appropriate.
Mm-hmm. And, then,
and it might deem lesser remedies appropriate. Unfortunately, yeah. The Secretary only has one choice, and that is all or nothing.
Yes.
Now, I would like to suggest that the stepping in the day before and giving a temporary restraining order and holding off several months before entering its final preliminary injunction in this case, in a sense, promoted the purposes of this act that the opposing counsel here say were frustrated. It allowed the union to engage in conciliation and get a prompt resolution. It just conciliated in front of the court. And in fact, the conciliation was successful. The union proposed all but several very minor terms of the order, with the exception of the court's supervision, and those minor terms of the order to which the union objected had nothing to do with the running of the election. It had to do with enjoining future violations and the like, and not posting bond for the appeal. Secondly, it afforded the union as much of an opportunity to voluntarily redress the wrongs that it had been engaged in as a Title IV process would have if just supported it at an earlier time. And it did not encroach on Title IV's principle of not removing persons elected from office until it's reasonably clear their election was unlawful. It was reasonably clear as soon as the evidence was heard in this case, and Judge Keaton so determined. The processes engaged in by the district court here and approved by the Court of Appeals balance the rights and remedies provided in Titles 1 and 4 in such a way as to allow them to complement each other rather than conflict with each other. Unless there are any further questions, we respectfully request the court to affirm the...
Let me ask, suppose that after, say the election had taken place in this case and you went to the secretary and complained and he investigated and thought that the election, that the nominating process was defective and a new election should be running. Then he has to sue, doesn't he?
He has to sue unless they agree to it.
Yes. Well, and suppose he goes to court and he, what does he have to prove?
He has to prove not only the violations occurred, but that they
What's
may
it a
have...
What's a violation of? Title I?
Or Title IV. No. It has to be a violation of Title IV.
Well, but it's all, so the two sections overlap in the sense that he would prove there was a violation in the nominating process.
A violation of Title IV. A violation of Title I would not allow the Secretary to seek relief afterwards.
But I know, but it just happens to be a violation of, it was a violation of Title I also.
Fine.
And then he goes to court, and what kind of a decree does he get?
He gets first he has to prove, Justice White, yes. that the election,
Let's
the outcome may have been affected.
Yes, assume he does.
Then he gets a decree that provides for the election to be run under certain terms and conditions.
By the Secretary.
For the Secretary to observe the election.
Well, but isn't it pursuant to regulations that the Secretary has?
Yes.
I mean, it isn't terms that the court dreams up.
Well, if there are any, you're allowed to intervene
in
these proceedings.
I'll put it to you this way. If this election had taken, if this election had already gone on, and you went to the secretary, and he goes and proves, makes his case before the court, and there's going to be a new election, if the judge had then ordered the election pursuant to, in exactly the way he did in this case, he would be violating Title IV, wouldn't he?
Exactly the way he did in this case? I don't think so, Your Honor.
Well, I thought the secretary had rules, had a set of rules as to how elections, new elections were to be run.
Yes, but there's no, I don't believe under the...
You mean the court can displace them?
I don't believe the court did, the rules set down in this case are any different from the rules...
Is the court constrained by the regulations the secretary has issued as to how new elections are to be run?
Under Title IV?
Yes.
I don't believe the court is, Justice White. I believe the courts respect them, but I don't believe they
hardly,
are.
The exclusivity means hardly anything, then.
It hardly means anything, because it is the same court that sets the same terms. And if the union refused to run its own meeting under Title IV, the court would have done the same thing that it did here under Title IV. It would have had somebody else run the meeting. There wouldn't have been any other choice. Thank you, Your Honors.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Wilton?
What about my last question, though?
I'd be happy to start with it, Justice White. And the problem with Mr. Stern's analysis at that point is that he misconstrues the statute. The terms of the election that the secretary conducts are the terms set by the secretary.
And if in published regulations.
In published regulations, and after analyzing the union's rules and regulations. If you look at 402B of the statute, try once more. 402A2 of the statute provides that the order received by the secretary is to direct the conduct of an election or hearing and vote upon the removal of officers under the supervision of the secretary and in accordance with the provisions of this title and such rules and regulations as the secretary may prescribe. First statutory misconstruction that was presented to you. The second statutory misconstruction is Mr. Stern's statement that the Congress decided that where there was a violation of the statute in connection with an election, those officers should be displaced and new officers should be emplaced. Well, clearly the statute provides in 402A2 that in the interim, when an election has been challenged, the affairs of the organization shall be conducted by the officers elected and in such other manner as the Constitution and bylaws may provide, even where the election has been challenged. And remember, there is a presumption to the validity of that election. But even where it has been challenged, the officers elected most recently take office and run the union. That did not happen here. And for an entire year, we had lame duck officers running the operation. A moment about the way the union proposed the stipulations, so-called. The union offered to conduct a new election. Now, if, as Mr. Stern says, there were, in fact, massive violations here and the union was recalcitrant, then this court cannot accept his further conclusion that unions will also take the 2.5 years to litigate to death any suit of the Secretary of Labor. Because here, in fact, once those violations became obvious and once the litigation problems became obvious, the union here offered to conduct a new election and to grant the plaintiffs exactly the type of remedy they were looking for, so long as the district court modified his temporary restraining order to allow the union to conduct it under its own rules. The district court refused to do that. Thereafter, we engaged in 7 months' worth of negotiation over a preliminary injunction, during which, in answer to your question, Justice Brennan, the union repeatedly raised the argument as to the district court's jurisdiction, and there are citations in the briefs. I would also refer you to Joint Appendix 111-112, which is the clearest statement with counsel for the union saying, Your Honor, we don't agree to any of this. Regardless of who you appoint, we object to your fundamental authority to appoint or to set aside the results. And the court saying, yes, I understand that, but we appreciate your participation in these discussions. So it is a great misstatement of the record. And in fact, the Court of Appeals found that the union did not agree to the terms of the election that the court ordered. If we accept Mr. Stern's contention that the 1983 election moots this case, then we're left in the anomalous position on the basis of glass bottle blowers that only the secretary can fully litigate a Title IV complaint, and only where he loses at the district court. Because if the union wins at the district, if the union loses at the district court and then is subsequently caught up in its next regularly scheduled election, then that suit may be mooted out by the conduct of that election. I suggest that does not afford the union the due process rights that is inherent. Thank you.
Case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.